forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. I have two guests together, Dr. Javier Amador. He's the founder of the LEAP Institute, and Janet Hayes. She's the founder of Healing Minds NOLA, North Louisiana. So we're going to be talking about the topic of schizophrenia, of which Dr. Amador, unfortunately, has a personal connection to, which we'll talk about, and not sure about Janet's connection to it, but I'm sure there is one. So welcome, both of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you. Likewise.
Javier, if we don't mind, let's start with you. Tell me a bit about your background and, you know, what was your encounter with schizophrenia?
Well, I've had countless encounters with people with schizophrenia. I'm a clinical psychologist and did a research for 20 years at Columbia University in New York. But really, my most profound and life-changing experience with schizophrenia was when my older brother, Henry, developed the illness when I was 21 years old. And it was a real struggle. Henry wanted no part of what anyone was offering, did not understand he had illness. And it led to about 7 years of me fumbling and arguing with my brother until I figured out a way to reach him and get him in treatment and into recovery.
Yeah, it seems very common with people that have schizophrenia or even other disorders, bipolar, et cetera, that I guess they see someone's concern as an attack upon them and they resist treatment. And, you know, from what I've heard with schizophrenics, even when, I guess maybe other disorders too, they'll stop taking meds at certain times and then, you know, go back into that defensive posture. Why do you think that happens and how common is that in your experience?
Well, I don't have an opinion about it so much. Which is just what the facts say. There's a tremendous amount of research. Between 50 and 75% of people with schizophrenia do not take medication at all or will not take it reliably. And the biggest predictor is a symptom that renders the person incapable of understanding they have a mental illness. It's a tongue twister. It's called anosognosia. It was identified by a neurologist back in 1919 for neurological patients unaware of things like paralysis. It's wildly fascinating. The first time I evaluated somebody like that, he was paralyzed in the left side of his body. He didn't know it. And I asked him to move his arm. He said, "I can do it, no problem. It doesn't move." Instead of learning, "Oh, maybe something's wrong with my arm," he became paranoid and thought I had put something in his IV to paralyze his arm. And back in 1990, wow. My colleagues and I, it's wild. I mean, have you ever read Oliver Sacks' book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat?
I just saw it as I recommend you read on Amazon. But I had heard of, maybe a crazy one is Cotard syndrome, where people think that they're dead and nothing to convince them otherwise. So it sounds like maybe it's in a similar vein.
It is. I mean, it's essentially almost kind of a special delusion. But we know now that in schizophrenia, it affects 50% of people with the illness. And it is the top predictor. And think about it for a minute. And I think Janet is very tuned into this problem. But if everybody around you is telling you you're mentally ill, telling you you don't have a podcast, you never started the companies you started, it's all delusion, you would, right? I already heard your first response. Yeah.
No, I would say, what are you talking about?
You wouldn't take medication for that, right?
No, you're right, because I would think they're crazy. I mean,
exactly.
But Janet, what's been your experience with interacting with people that have this issue? What have you seen?
Well, first of all, I think I founded Healing Minds NOLA, and I think I am the director and work with a in New Orleans with a judge to help people with untreated and undertreated serious mental illnesses to sort of compel them to stay in treatment and help them, you know, get better. So my experience really, I'm coming at it from a little different angle, which is the angle of injustices toward people living with these illnesses who have been untreated and undertreated as a result of systemic barriers over long periods of time. And apologies in advance for my dogs who seem to be decided to have a war right when I want to do an interview. So, you know, and the average length of time between diagnosis and treatment can be anywhere from, you know, 6 years to 10 to 15 years, which obviously presents a whole other set of problems, and that the person is sick and without treatment continue to deteriorate and only get worse. And by the the time they actually are finding treatment, they are so deteriorated that it makes it so much more difficult for them to get better. So I started looking at how we can get people into treatment earlier interventions, but really specialize. Now, not all people have associated lack of insight that Dr. Amador is, you know, describing, but a lot of them do. And those are the ones that are really falling through the cracks. So few people are really focused on that population and how to remove barriers for them. And so I decided that, you know, as my life's work at some point, that would be my focus, to work really specifically with folks who are suffering with or living with, you know, these illnesses that are really neurological in nature, who will not get better without some sort of involuntary intervention. And so I started looking at the most therapeutic way of doing intervention, which connected me with the Treatment Advocacy Center, a national organization that also focuses on this population, that really started what's called assisted outpatient treatment. And we can talk about that more. But that's also how I ran into Dr. Amador and a whole group of other wonderful people who advocate for better policy to, you know, to be able to unlock program services that people need in order to be able to get back on their feet and back into the community.
So I guess we'll go, you know, we'll go back and forth. So yeah, Javier, why do you think people are so resistant? I mean, again, like you gave the example with me, to me, it's obvious, supposedly I'm, you know, mentally competent, but why does this happen? Why does this seem to accompany certain mental conditions? Or do you think it's a separate thing that's, you know, coincident with this?
It's a central feature of schizophrenia. We see it in bipolar disorder, and we see it in alcohol and substance abuse, where the frontal lobes of the brain are essentially underactive. So this is part of, you know, what Janet was talking about. This is a neurocognitive symptom that is central to the other symptoms that come from these disorders. And the thing that's really frustrating for me, and it's why I left a tenured position at Columbia University to start doing advocacy work, is that there's this big gap between science and practice. When I read your story, I thought, wow, there it is again, where the people on the front line, the families, first and foremost, but also the clinicians and law enforcement and judges, that they don't know about the research. And what is the research? What's the headline? The headline is this symptom that renders people incapable of understanding they're ill leaves them incapable of making intelligent, you know, voluntary choice about treatment. They avoid treatment, they run from treatment, they end up homeless, they end up in our criminal justice system. And it's all because the research has not been disseminated. That's been my life's mission for the last 20 years, and that's why I'm really happy to accept your invitation to join you and Janet. It's to educate the public and others that are working with people with schizophrenia that you have to address the symptom. And I'll just say one more thing real quickly. There are two ways that we approach this. In my book, I'm Not Sick, I Don't Need Help, you know, half of the book is all about a communication strategy to engage people in treatment without telling them they're sick. It's a completely different, counterintuitive approach. And then the other half of the book is about assisted outpatient treatment and other forms of involuntary treatment. But there are, again, there's research on both of those strategies, and they often are underemployed. You know, Janet said people are falling through the cracks. I'm going to disagree with you, Janet. People are pushed through the cracks by the policies that we have, the public policies we have. HIPAA, you know, HIPAA is a huge disaster when it comes to people with this illness and this symptom, because families who are on the front line can't talk to the doctors who are treating their loved ones. So a big gap between research and practice that needs to be closed. And, you know, I'm really glad people like Janet Hayes are out there and the Treatment Advocacy Center is out there changing public policy.
Yeah. So back to you for a minute, Janet. What do you think are the reasons, or how do you get through to someone that thinks that nothing's wrong with them, but yet they do need help?
Yeah, well, and thanks, Dr. Amador, for the correction. I'm going to use that from now on, because I agree that, yes, policy that is actually, it's designed, the system is designed not to work, and it doesn't. And we really are pushing people through the cracks. And I don't want to say it's intentional, but there's certainly intentional neglect. So in our program, and the court program that I help run with Judge Kurdweis, we do incorporate the techniques that Dr. Amador has, you know, that teaches about the listening, empathize, agree, and partner method to work with individuals to motivate them positively in order to, you know, help them understand they need to look after their mental health needs in order to do the things that they want to do. And whether they believe that the medications are working for them or not, we can usually get people to agree to adhere to treatment, adhere to medications, because that allows them then to do the things that they want to do. Whether they know that whether they ever admit they have a mental illness or not is irrelevant.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now, back to the show.
Why would they agree to anything if they feel like nothing's wrong with them?
Well, you know, we have a great judge that we work with who really focuses on other issues with people with serious mental illnesses, and that they want to work, they want to go to school. You know, maybe they have a hobby they like to do. Maybe they want to start their own business or something like that. And so what we do is we work with them on those issues, and we're here to help. And, you know, but we're also here to help keep you out of the hospital, keep you out of jail, keep you out of homelessness. You've been hospitalized, your doctor is encouraging that you take these medications or follow this treatment plan in order to be able to stay in the community and out of the hospital. And so sometimes it doesn't start off like ideally, but after some time in the program, they may get rehospitalized. In the hospital, they're given medication, they get better, they get out, they start to make the connection between, oh, you know, when I'm on my medications, I'm okay. When I'm not on my medications, I'm not okay. And a lot of the time they do regain their insight. Most of the time we find that they do. We have one case where they never regained insight. We have one case of a individual who has schizophrenia, who absolutely, he insists that he will not take his medications as soon as he's out of our program, but he takes his medications because the judge tells him to. And when he started out in the program, I mean, he's a completely different person. You wouldn't recognize that he was the same person. And I'm not sure that he recognizes that he's not the same person, but he's doing the things he wants to do in his life, and he's succeeding doing them. He has friends. He now has a girlfriend. He has a job. You know, he is connected to community. And he's an amazing success story. We keep him in the program because he says as soon as he's off, he's not going to take his medication. So we just keep him in. So for now, that's where we are with him. So it really is meeting people where they are.
Well, and I'm going to add to that, Janet. I'm going to take out my crystal ball here. I bet you that the person you're talking about feels that the judge, not just because the judge tells him to take the medication, he probably feels the judge respects him, likes him, doesn't judge him. And that's what the research shows, is that when you build a very specific kind of relationship where you validate the person's experience, you don't agree with them if they say, you know, the CIA is surveilling them, but you listen to them. And that's the listen, empathize, agree, partner, the LEAP approach Janet was talking about. If you listen to them instead of arguing with them, if you listen to them instead of trying to educate them, if you're empathic, what the research shows is people are willing to take medication even though they don't believe they're ill. My brother's a prime example. After 20 years of being on a long-acting injectable antipsychotic medication, I asked him, do you think you have schizophrenia? And he said, no, I don't have it. And he laughed. I said, so why in the world are you taking these shots? And he said, I do it for you. So what was his answer? He did it for a relationship. And I bet you in your program, Janet, the judge and the court staff and you and anybody who interacts with the people that come through your program feel not judged and respected. And it's counterintuitive. It's weird, but it works.
Well, I guess one potential irony is that it would be weird to feel not judged by a judge, but...
Well, that's the magic sauce, isn't it, really?
It is.
And this is a civil process also, by the way, not a criminal process. But when you're in front of somebody, any of us, if we go before somebody who's wearing a black robe and they're telling us what we need to do, we typically will, you know, we typically listen to a judge because they have authority. And so they represent authority when you come into the court. But in AOT, in assisted outpatient treatment, also known as AOT, they also act as the person's motivator and their friend. So we have people that are in our program that stay in treatment and, you know, adhere to the program because they want the judge to be proud of them. Because the judge is, you know, the judge is the authority figure, but also the friend, you know, a good role model, really.
it's probably been tried, but has anyone asked someone with schizophrenia, can I film you and show you the film later to show you that, you know,
there's
something going on here? Like, how recalcitrant are these people? Will they, no matter what you say or put in front of them, they just won't agree?
In the first edition of the book I told you about, my book, in the appendix, I have a review of exactly that kind of study. It did not improve awareness of illness. So this person saw a video of themselves. Well, not this person. There were actually about 20 people in the study. But one that stands out to me is somebody who saw a video of himself talking to voices and talking about delusion that there was an alien transmitter in his brain. He watched that video, then did, as part of the research protocol, a questionnaire. And he came up with, there's nothing wrong with me. That was me joking around. It's called a confabulation. He saw the evidence he was ill and he explained it away. There's nothing wrong with him. So that doesn't work. Education does not work in that sense. Long-term reliable treatment. Yeah, it's fascinating to see. That's why I mentioned the Oliver Sacks book, the man who mistook his wife for a hat. He actually describes a number of cases where you see that symptom, anosognosia, where neurological patients are unaware of various neurological symptoms. It's really mind-blowing when you see it, actually.
Is anyone looking at a microbiome or diet and how that affects people with, you know, bipolar or schizophrenia?
Not that I'm aware of. A little bit of the research that I have looked at around wheat, for example, is coming up pretty empty, actually. It's doesn't seem to be having any impact, certainly on this symptom or the symptoms of schizophrenia. That said, you know, diet is really important, and diet can affect, we know it does affect mood and depression. So it's, you know, really important to be paying attention to diet.
Well, has anyone sampled the microbiome of people with schizophrenia versus people that are not schizophrenic to see if there's differences? And I know that everyone's microbiome is different and stuff.
Yeah, it's a great question. Not that I'm aware of. No, I haven't looked at that research in probably 10 years. So maybe there's something new since 2014.
Anything definitive on that either? And I do look at that because I'm on social media a lot and these things come up. And so I'm always watching for, you know, the silver bullet that kind of that proves that diet and, yeah, I mean, there are, I agree with Dr. Amador, diet is super important for a lot of reasons, but whether or not neurological brain disease can be attributed to a diet, I don't think that that's been showing yet. But however, if it ever is, I'm pretty sure whoever discovers that will get a Nobel.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a cure. We'll find it out. It'll be a headline of the day for sure.
Well, how well does the LEAP protocol work? You know, how much more effective is it?
In a double-blind placebo-controlled study that we published, it worked for 78% of the patients who had no awareness of their illness. And that was a controlled, you know, placebo-controlled study using a very commonly used psychotherapy, client-centered therapy. And LEAP was far superior.
Yeah, that's amazing. How does schizophrenia start? It seems like a triggering event, you know, stress, a girlfriend breaks up with you, or my uncle, you know, supposedly he was in the military and, you know, Navy, and that's what did it. That's what triggered him. You know, this is like in the 50s. But what have you seen causes the onset of schizophrenia?
Well, stress and trauma definitely can trigger the revealing of schizophrenia. I mean, we can call it the onset, but it's really not clinically accurate. It's more that the person already has more subtle symptoms, and then stress reveals and exacerbates those symptoms. Symptoms like delusions, right? Strange, implausible ideas that other people don't share. You know, I don't want to talk about politics for a minute, but or not. So it's really an environmental gene interaction. It's not wholly a genetic disorder, but you can have genetic risk for the disorder. Other risk factors are in utero during the second trimester of gestation, exposure to influenza virus has been shown, exposure to nutrition, actually to starvation, has been shown. Now, it's a really fascinating study that has to do with the Nazi blockade of the Netherlands and famine.
The Dutch hunger winter?
Yeah, exactly. And first and third trimester fetuses exposed to starvation did not have a higher risk of schizophrenia, only the second trimester. And that was noteworthy because that's during what's called neural tube propagation. So it's linked to a very specific pathophysiological process. But to summarize, so in utero, insults to the brain, early childhood head traumas, these have been shown to increase your risk of developing schizophrenia and first degree relatives. So an uncle, a brother, a parent, a sister, a brother.
How much is the likelihood increased if you have a first degree relative with it?
From 1% to about 6%, 4 to 6%. Yeah. Which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot. I can tell you, as a brother of somebody with schizophrenia, jumping from 1% to 6% was pretty scary for me for a long time.
Yeah. Jenny, you were going to say something? I'm sorry.
So no, that's sort of my understanding as well, that, you know, serious mental illness is something that can't be prevented. If a person is going to develop serious mental illness, they're going to develop it, and also can't be cured, but it can be managed. And it can be managed very successfully with treatments that are out there. And the sad thing is that that's not utilized more, unlike other brain diseases like Alzheimer's, you know, dementia, Parkinson's disease, you know, where there's really, I mean, the treatments are not as effective for some of the other kinds of brain diseases that are out there. And it's just always bewildering to me that when we have treatments that work, we're not using them more effectively, especially in now, like serious mental illness, schizophrenia can develop at any age, but, you know, most likely a development's going to be in late teens, early 20s. When you're dealing with a population so young, with so much life ahead of them, you know, it seems like we would be doing everything under the sun we can to help them manage their disease so they can have longer lives and higher quality of life. And it's amazing to me that we don't. But I also wanted to add on that, you know, as program director for court program in New Orleans and the other work I do, I get referrals, all kinds of different referrals. And I think now we're seeing symptoms sometimes that resemble schizophrenia that may not necessarily be schizophrenia, which kind of complicate matters and confuse things for people. Sometimes we see onset of psychosis as related to a substance use disorder or substance induced. And so those kinds of psychoses can resemble schizophrenia, but they usually will dissipate or go away once the person stops using the drug. And so I think there are folks that kind of see, oh, well, it can be cured because this person had these symptoms of psychosis and they were having the same delusions or visual or auditory hallucinations and they went away. So therefore it's curable. And I think there's a lot of overlap now with substance induced psychosis that it confuses the public and it also confuses doctors. You know, it takes a really skilled psychiatrist to be able to evaluate somebody, especially like when they're hospitalized or even not hospitalized, if they go to a clinic, to be able to determine exactly what the problem is, get a good diagnosis, and then get a person on a good treatment plan. And I mean, sadly, sometimes now we're seeing people with irreversible substance-induced psychosis, more complicated. And they go into the hospital. Usually it's the young kids, they're doing drugs, maybe 17 or 18 went to a party and they experience a psychotic break and medications are not effective for substance-induced psychosis. Medications that we have for serious mental illness can be very effective for most people, not all people, but, you know, there's that as well. So what do you do? I mean, if you're a doctor and someone comes into your hospital, first of all, you have to figure out, is this substance induced or is this genetically or environmentally induced? So there's a whole raft of stuff out there now.
I wanted to get to the medicine part in a minute, but one thing that jumps to mind is, you know, there's cognitive distortions associated with people that have depression or bipolar, et cetera. I can't remember the name of the disorder that you just said, or you said a while ago, Javier, you don't believe that there's anything wrong with you, but anosognosia. Okay. Seems like there's a temporary anosognosia when someone is in the depths of depression or bipolar, or let's say they're in the down or the manic phase. Is there any insight to be gained from that? Because again, the cognitive distortions, catastrophizing, black and white thinking, et cetera, they seem to be manifestations of this, but temporary ones.
I'd like to say two things about that. First, the nature of anosognosia, this unawareness in bipolar disorder, tends to wax and wane, just like the other symptoms of bipolar disorder, like pressured speech, sleeplessness, mania. So you do see during a manic phase of the illness that the anosognosia is exacerbated.
It's alive and well.
And then during the depressive phase, the anosognosia, just like the manic symptoms, remits. So that's you know, a little bit about the heterogeneity of that symptom. But the other thing I wanted to say is that I want to emphasize what Janet said earlier. There's no cure, like for other dementias, like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. But unlike those dementias, and by the way, schizophrenia was originally called dementia praecox, which means early dementia. It doesn't affect the brain in the same way by any means, but it is a neurodevelopmental disorder, just like dementias are. So there's no cure, but in the case of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, we do have treatments, not only medication, which I guess we're going to talk about, but also, you're spot on in your question. Cognitive behavioral therapy for psychosis is highly effective, and it was first studied only in patients who did not respond to medicine, did not respond to antipsychotic medication. But now it's being much more widely used, and I use it in my clinical practice to reduce delusionality, to reduce hallucinations. So those cognitive distortions can be worked with in many, not all, but many people with this illness.
So on the medication side, I guess, I'll start with Janet. Why do the medications for schizophrenia work at all? What is the mechanism of action? They must understand something about the disease, that unless it's an accidental find of these medications.
Yeah, I mean, that sucks. So I'm not a doctor or a clinician, so that's kind of out of my wheelhouse. I'm going to defer back to Dr. Amador, who probably knows more about that than I do. But, you see in the work that I do, various kinds of medications that are used. Some people respond better to some than others. That's why you want a skilled psychiatrist to kind of feel it out with the patient when they first start with someone who's having a psychotic break. You need to break the psychosis, right? So medications are very effective in doing that. Not all people respond the same way to all medications. Some people have allergies to certain medications, and there are some that are better than others, that some have more side effects than others. Most of them have some side effect, which can be a little discouraging also for folks, and sometimes a reason why they don't want to take their medication. But we can definitely work with side effects with our clients, and over time those tend to wane, especially as once medications, usually when people start, they have they usually start them on a higher dose and then titrate down to a more manageable dose, so they're not feeling the side effects as much. But in terms of the specific medications that are being used and the chemical interaction or the biological nature of it, I'm not a clinician.
Okay.
But that's been my observation, has been that medications can be very effective with most people, not all. Some people are treatment resistant, and that's getting into a whole other ball game. But and I also do want to say with the anosognosia, I do see that also come and go. So I see insight, as Dr. Amador said, wax and wane. It's sometimes anosognosia is temporary, usually when the person is symptomatic, and then when they're back in treatment, goes away. And we have, I've seen people sit in front of our judge, and it's not just the court program that I work with, but in this particular situation environment, I've seen people sit in front of the judge and say, I'm just like everybody else, but I have schizophrenia, when that same person, 6 months before had no idea that they had schizophrenia, had no
right.
one
okay.
that they were sick at all. So
yeah, and in terms of I've seen the same thing in terms of mechanisms of action. Like a lot of medical disorders, the first treatment for schizophrenia that really worked well was a serendipitous discovery, and it affected the dopamine system. So dopamine is a chemical messenger in the brain. It's a neurotransmitter. Today, we know that at least several neurotransmitter systems are involved in schizophrenia. And to put it crudely, it's essentially a chemical imbalance. The brain is functioning differently. It's metabolizing neurotransmitters differently. There's blockade of neurotransmitters at the level of neurons. So in short, we know that neurotransmitters are a major issue in terms of the symptoms of schizophrenia, but the brains also look different. So we do see structural differences, especially in the prefrontal cortex, things like reduced gray matter. So it doesn't affect intelligence. It's not like somebody's less intelligent or less creative or more creative for that matter. But we see both functional, how the brain's working, and structural, how the brain looks, differences. But with respect to mechanisms of action, most of the research is focused on dopamine and GABA and a couple of other neurotransmitter systems. And that's what the medications target.
Oh, so they'll either increase or decrease the production of one or more of these neurotransmitters.
Exactly. It's complex. I mean, it's really complex, actually. I mean, you think about billions of neurons in our brain and the multitude of neurotransmitters that are utilized by the neurons in our brain to communicate with one another. And it's not surprising that it's complex. That said, I can't overemphasize what Janet's saying. these treatments really work well for the majority of patients, not for all, but for the majority. And they're underutilized. And the biggest reason people refuse treatment is anosognosia and not understanding they're ill. And then, and Janet, I'm going to disagree with you on one point, at least with respect to the research. I thought when I looked at the research initially that side effects, bad experiences with side effects, would predict who refuses treatment. Turns out it doesn't. We hear that from our patients all the time because they know that's what we're interested in talking about. We're not interested in hearing, I'm not sick. We are interested in hearing, you know, about something we can do something about. I'm on blood pressure medication. The first medication I got made me dizzy. I had orthostatic hypotension. You know, whenever I stood up, I'd get real dizzy. Well, I didn't stop all medication, refuse to take medication for the rest of my life, like so many with schizophrenia do. What I did is went back to my doctor and like you were talking about, Janet, found a medication and did not give me that side effect. So side effects are really important. We have to address them. We have to listen when someone tells us they're having bad side effects. But if they would throw the baby out with the bathwater, if they say, well, I'm not taking any medication, it's almost always anosognosia, this unawareness of illness. And it makes sense. If you don't believe you're ill, if you're certain you don't have this illness, why in the world would you take medication? There's no reason. Other than relationships, back to what we were talking about earlier, where you really feel a lot of trust and you do it for somebody else because they want you to do it.
Do people have memory of the anosognosia? You know, if it lessens for some reason and you're able to talk to them, do they remember those previous conversations?
And those that recover from that symptom, the folks that Janet was talking about, I've had a lot of interviews with many people like that. I know Janet has too. They look back and say, wow, I can't believe I didn't understand that I had an illness. I see it today. I see it.
Yeah, yeah. I do see that. In fact, we have a case, not in Orleans, where I'm just, you know, heartwarming. I mean, it's just watch people recover. There's nothing more heartwarming than watch somebody get better. But anyway, we're leaving the courtroom after the hearing. I think this was the initial hearing. Very concerned brother. Really difficult for the family to bring this person, file this petition for an involuntary outpatient commitment for a loved one, worried about how he was going to react and the relationship and so on. It's really hard for the families to do to help or to involuntarily intervene. But after the hearing and walking out, and he had taken his medication and he had already met with it was an ACT provider, a sort of community treatment. He's a wraparound team that come to his house, provide him with everything he needs. And after this hearing, he walked out and he looked back and he said, my days of not knowing I'm not sick are over. I'm never going on my medication ever again.
I've seen that too. No, it's about 20% according to the research. I have seen that exactly what you're describing.
Yeah, but just, you know, and you sit in the courtroom and you cry tears of joy. The moments are, I mean, you can't even describe that because of the stress and the struggle is so intense. And then when you see somebody actually, you know, when things click and you know they're on their way and they're on the right path, it's just like... Mm.
Are judges, do they get special training in anosognosia and, you know, when they deal with people that have, you know, mental disorders in front of them? Because otherwise, I mean, very bad things could happen, I would think.
At Leap Institute.
Amador's training.
Exactly. I was going to say at Leap Institute, we've trained hundreds of judges and they love the program because it helps them engage and collaborate with the person that's in front of them in their courtroom and gain their trust and become a friend. It's professional friendship, but it's a friendship. I know that, again, sounds counterintuitive, but a judge can act like a friend, someone who cares, someone who maybe even likes you and somebody who listens to you and then says, this is what you need to do or this is what I'd like you to do. And it has... So we train a lot of judges. We train judges. We train district attorneys. We train law enforcement. We train who so often are on the front line encountering people with schizophrenia.
Yeah. Not all judges have the aptitude or personality to be an AOT judge, but the ones that do will find you. I mean, or you find them. They have a special quality for sure. A person that's able to, you know, relate to the respondent again with respect and has curiosity and interest matter. So, and our judge we're so fortunate. He was actually previously a family court judge, and I hope he's not listening. He's a little older, but he would say the same thing, but he's kind of the older, wiser one, you know, and so people respect him for that. And also, you know, he's very well known and connected in the community, and he can, again, help, you know, our respondents if they need a job or if they want to go to school, you know, he'll work with them. He always says, use me as a referral. You know, I'll do this for you. I'll make a phone call. I need you to cooperate. As long as you're cooperating, I'm going to go to the ends of the earth to help you get the things you need in your life. And some people, you know, the respondents sit in front of it. A lot of them, they'll comment. They'll say, you're kidding. You know, they just can't believe somebody with his authority would care that much about him.
And I'll tell you, the judges that come to our training, they have that personality. They're the ones who are self-selected, really.
That's excellent, yeah. That's good to know. For a moment, going back to the drugs that can induce temporary or permanent psychosis, I've heard that marijuana is one, particularly for teens, that can produce psychosis and can exacerbate schizophrenia or other problems, bipolar, et cetera. What have you guys seen?
Well, it can trigger. The research is clear. It's associated with the onset of schizophrenia in people vulnerable. So they have some of the vulnerabilities I was talking about earlier. Either a genetic predisposition, head injuries in early childhood, in second trimester in utero, insults to the brain. And then they start smoking marijuana in their teens. And we do know that heavy marijuana use does trigger that predisposition into full-blown schizophrenia.
Yeah, I think the research is pretty clear on that. And then also you have the synthetic THC.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really...
Well, like THCA, THCO, Delta-8, all that stuff.
I don't know the names of them all, but I do know that psychosis induced by synthetic THC is a lot more serious. Well, it's not serious. It's all serious. But I know that those are the people that sometimes have irreversible psychosis. And so, you know, and also I think synthetic THC is one of those drugs that does induce psychosis that isn't necessarily correlated with a person who had a predisposition for serious mental illness. So somebody with no predisposition for serious mental illness that's using synthetic THC and some of the other drugs that are out there can become psychotic, irreversibly psychotic, that can't be treated. That's the really horrific thing. But we, you know, that's another topic. It's sort of getting away from the topic of this particular interview, but it's definitely something that folks should be concerned about, I think.
But for, you know, for schizophrenia, though, like yeah. Schizophrenia, which are the drugs that are the most likely to cause additional problems?
Well, marijuana is the research is abundantly clear that heavy marijuana use is associated with triggering the onset of schizophrenia. So it's not a drug-induced psychosis like Janet was talking about. That typically resolves within 48 hours of stopping the substance. It is you know, triggering a lifelong incurable illness, schizophrenia.
Yeah. I think there's probably a lot more research that could be done around a lot of the other drugs, but marijuana is the one that has been
studied the most.
Yeah. And there's a ton of research out there showing the harmful effects of marijuana, especially for people with a predisposition for serious mental illness.
Okay. Any promising treatments or methods that are up and coming that we haven't mentioned that are still being tested?
Well, there's a number. Well, it's interesting. The pharmaceutical industry has been really lax in investing in new treatments. So that's just sort of a preamble to my answer. So we don't have as many as I think we'd all like to see in the pipeline. But there are medications that are addressing neurotransmitter systems other than dopamine that are showing a lot of promise. So we do have that in the pharmaceutical end of the spectrum. And then in the psychotherapeutic, talk therapy end of the spectrum, CBT for psychosis, cognitive behavioral therapy for psychosis, the evidence base is just growing and growing and growing over the last 20 years. Really effective for many people with schizophrenia.
Yeah, I think there's like a lot of new kind of innovative approaches that are being shown to be successful in like first episode psychosis programs, which is a super early intervention. It's really designed around people who are having their first psychotic break in doing all kinds of, we have the program here and there's programs all over the place where they're doing, you know, a lot of different, it is talk therapy, but then also different kind of virtual reality, or they have that, what's the virtual you can go into virtual realities and so on. There's a technique, I don't know the names of them all, but they're really interesting. And so on medicinal.
Right.
But
and the other one I forgot to mention, you reminded me of, is a transcranial magnetic stimulation.
A lot of
research going on where it's essentially magnets that are very precise that stimulate different brain regions and produce neurotransmitters very localized, right, in the brain, in a particular part of the brain that you're interested in, rather than taking medication, which is systemic, which affects, you know, your entire body. So transcranial magnetic stimulations, I'm really excited about it. I think in another 10 to 20 years, we're going to see that used much more widely. It's barely used at all outside of research settings.
Yeah. I think NIMH could invest a lot more in clinical research. I mean, they spend a lot of money on sort of biological research, looking for cures for, you know, neurological diseases, brain diseases, and not spending as much on clinical treatment or evidence-based programs and sort of. They're not looking at that as much as maybe they should. I think they should be just in that, you know, cures are great, but there are people who are struggling right now. We have, like, I don't know what the numbers are, but about 3 to 4% of Americans have serious mental illness. Their jails.
You said three to 4%.
4% of Americans. That's a lot of people.
You're including schizophrenia, schizoaffective, delusional disorder, bipolar disorder. Yeah, schizophrenia is around 1%, which is 3 million people, more than 3 million people.
Right.
Yes, it's not a rare disease.
No, and we've relegated them to institutionalization or incarceration, you know, homelessness in and out of hospitals. And so they're there now. I mean, again, cures are great. I'm all for cures. But at the same time, what do we do right now to correct those mistakes that we've made with the people who have suffered our mistakes but are also coming up? You know, they're more, I mean, developing serious mental illnesses every day. So what are we doing for them right now?
The real tragedy is we have treatments that work right now, help manage symptoms, and people aren't getting them nearly as much as often as they need to. I mean, we're talking about 1.5 million people with this illness at a minimum are not in treatment.
Right.
And again, the number one cause. Yeah.
Well, what are the drugs that you know of that, you know, possibly could help somebody? And if someone has a loved one that, you know, appears to have schizophrenia, what kind of practitioners would recommend them and which ones wouldn't know about them?
Well, I mean, most psychopharmacologists, so nurse practitioners, psychiatrists, know about antipsychotic medication, and we have over 20 of them. So I won't go down the whole list. But one thing I do want to say is there was a lot of hoopla about the newer second generation atypical antipsychotics. And the research there shares that they're generally, in terms of their efficacy in improving the symptoms, not any better generally than the first generation. And I'm talking all the way back to Thorazine, clobramazine is actually still an effective drug for hundreds of thousands of people. But, you know, that's, I'm not making a pitch for the first generation, but I am making a pitch for having a full spectrum of antipsychotic medications, because the research also shows we don't know who will respond to which one. So you really want to have your palate full of every color.
Yeah, and most of those diagnoses, I mean, usually it's usually that the diagnosis, hopefully, what happens in a clinical setting with a psychiatrist or a professional nurse, psychiatric nurse practitioner, or somebody who can work with the individual over time to be able to see what medication the person responds to. And if they're not responding, then titrate off before trying a new one. So, you know, when we get into these kind of rushed hospitalizations due to insurance capitations where doctors don't have enough time to really observe the individual and how they respond to the medication before they're discharged, then sometimes, you know, they have to come back a few more times to get on the right medication. So that's critical also, the doctor-patient relationship. And ideally, I mean, people shouldn't really have to go to a hospital to get a good diagnosis and on a medication that's going to work for them. But, you know, for folks that don't respond right away, sometimes that is the best way to do it.
Okay. Well, very good. Both of you have been very generous. We'll close out in a minute. For people listening that suspect or have a, you know, an issue with a loved one or someone they know, what are the first steps they can take to get help and get a diagnosis and all that?
If they can get their loved one in to see one of the professionals, Janet was just talking about, psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, et cetera, psychiatric nurse practitioners, go immediately. However, if they are among the more than million families where the loved one has anosognosia, learn how to engage them, learn how to communicate with them in a way that optimizes the chance. They're going to say, okay, I'll take medication. Like my brother said, I'll take it even though I don't need it, but I'll do it for you. Right. So learn communication strategies to engage the person in treatment.
Again, Janet, what do you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to, unprompted, throw the Treatment Advocacy Center organization name out there. Contact, if you're not sure where to find resources in your community or in your state, you might want to start with them. They do have folks that will respond to you to point you in the right direction in whatever geography you live in. You know, and in our area in Louisiana, you can contact me. I think my organization is Healing Minds NOLA, and I can put you in touch with, you know, the right or anyone, any people that are practicing in this field that can help. And I can sometimes help connect people also to the programs that I'm talking about with support. But yeah, the Treatment Advocacy Center is a wonderful resource, and they do a lot of research and have a lot of information on their website regarding what's available in different states, and also state laws and commitment laws and so on, and how that works in various different states. But I highly also endorse Dr. Amador's program, and that people, and I always, whenever I get a referral, I always refer families to the LEAP method, and they're always grateful to learn about it, just to be able to communicate better with a loved one that is living and you know, that need to sometimes be able to de-escalate conflicts in the family that are happening because they're not understanding exactly what's going on with their loved one. And, you know, it's not their fault. They're not just denial. They're not in denial. They're not trying to cause problems. They're not, you know, being resistant intentionally to suggestions or treatment, but they have a real illness that's affecting a part of the brain that they can't control and didn't ask for. So yeah.
Okay. Well, very good. Very good.
Recommendations.
Okay. Well, thank you both for coming on the podcast very much. I appreciate it.
Very welcome.
You. Thank you for all you do also, Richard. It's wonderful education series that you have going, and appreciate you.
You know, thank you.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius Podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius Podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at FindingGeniusPodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.